Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everybody, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and today I have with me Doug Daspit. Doug is a board-certified chaplain. Currently, he works full-time as a police chaplain and an Army Reserve chaplain. He's also been a pastor, a church planner, as well as a hospital and hospice chaplain. He has been a chaplain for 12 years, and a side note, that he is being promoted to lieutenant colonel with the Army. Congratulations. Welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast, Doug.
I am happy to be here. Rachel, it's great to have a conversation with you again after many years.
After many years, we do have, I just said that date before we got on the call. Was it 97? 98 was around that time. Yes, we attended the
around
same
that college. Time.
Yes. And your beautiful wife, Crystal, was one of the best friends of my college roommate.
Yeah.
So it's a small, small world. Okay, Doug, tell us about, before we dive into the work that you do, can you tell us about your cultural upbringing and background?
Yeah, definitely. Happy to be here. I am from New Orleans, born and raised in New Orleans. I was raised in, as many New Orleanians are, in a Roman Catholic family that wasn't very committed to religion. But things changed a bit when I was about 12 or 13. My parents got divorced, and that was a pretty, you know, earth-shattering experience for my personal family. And I was the oldest kid, and I've learned how later on in life how that maybe impacted my ministry and what I do today. But born and raised in New Orleans, went away for college and seminary, and then came back to New Orleans. And I've been in New Orleans for, you know, married in ministry for over 20 years. So I'm a New Orleanian through and through. And a big part of my kind of story in this journey with chaplaincy and ministry is of course, being here in 2005 through Hurricane Katrina. Hmm. So I'm sure we'll get into that, but that's a bit of my background.
Absolutely. And then do you know your Enneagram? And I chuckle because you do.
I do.
Got some inside information.
So I, you know, I've been in ministry circles long enough to have taken about 45,000,
personality
tests. Uh-huh. And so when the Enneagram came out, I was like, I'm done. I'm not taking any more. I refuse. And my wife was all into it, so she talks about Enneagram numbers and stuff, and I refused to take the test. So she says I'm a five. I don't exactly know what that means. I have an idea because I've taken other tests, but she says I'm a five, never been tested, but probably the test of your wife is probably more accurate than any.
Sure. She's got the inside scoop. She knows. Yeah. Yeah, which the five is the investigator, which I sent over to you a little screenshot. You said it was life-changing. It's already changed your life in the, like, 2 hours that you've had that information.
That's right. Now finally know who I am.
Yes, but the five is fitting because I could say that four of all the types that are anti do not type me, that's the five. So you're kind of playing right into the stereotype, if I'm being honest. So it's totally fine. Fives
well,
are, it makes so much sense. I love it. Okay. So being from New Orleans and having chaplaincy in, how did you get there? How do you get to becoming a chaplain?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I in high school, I had a call to ministry, and I was one of those people through college and seminary that felt firmly like, I am devoted to the local church. That's what I want to do. I don't want to do parachurch ministry. I don't want to be a missionary. I just want to be a pastor. And that's what I did. You know, I started doing pastoral ministry right out of seminary, went back to my home church, in fact, and was a youth pastor and an associate pastor. But I always had a desire to figure out how to do church ministry outside of the walls of the church. Mm-hmm. That was always a passion for me. And then Hurricane Katrina hit, and we were all over our community doing all kinds of stuff. And so that really reshaped my view of my perspective on ministry, in that I was constantly looking for ways to engage my community. And so that is really the path that led me to chaplaincy. I wanted to find ways, as a pastor, was challenging my congregation to view their job as mission work, you know, as a way that they're ambassadors for the gospel in their community. I was trying to figure out how I do that. And so I knew chaplaincy was a natural way to for someone with ministry experience to be out in the marketplace, be out in the community and use those skills in a different way. And so that's what led me into chaplaincy. Once I got into it, I realized that it made a whole lot of sense for me in a lot of ways. And one of those ways is because I'm sure this is because I'm a 5 on the Enneagram.
I'm sure.
We'll
make it connect.
But my demeanor is I'm a calm presence. I'm someone who doesn't get really worked up. And I'm a relaxed, conversational kind of person. And I'm really curious and interested in hearing what people have to say. And I get excited about learning stuff. See,
the investigator, that makes
sense. It's all about Enneagram today.
Yes.
I figured out through engaging as a chaplain that there were things about the way I'm wired by God that just were really helpful to people when they were in the kind of spaces that chaplains usually provide ministry for. And so I'd be next to someone, I mean, whether you're talking about hospital or hospice or military or police chaplaincy, I'm usually around people when they're in a moment of crisis. And providing ministry for them. And it's been really satisfying, or meaningful maybe is a better word. It's been really meaningful to see how God can use me just in the way that I'm naturally designed in those moments.
Mm. So you end up getting through, you started a program, you joined the Army after Katrina, correct? Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I get through Katrina. I start church planting in an area of New Orleans. So I was pastoring in New Orleans, you know, is on the Mississippi River, cuts right through New Orleans, right? About 80% of the city is on one side of the river, which we call the East Bank, which is really more like the North Bank, but we call it the East Bank. And then the other side is the West Bank, small sliver of New Orleans and a lot of, I guess, suburbs. I lived in that 20% of the city that was on the other side of the river. So my home did not flood, and the church that I was pastoring at did not flood, but the area I had grown up in was across the river. And so I had so many relational, organic connections with people, with schools, with parks, with all kinds of elements of the community that had flooded. And so, so I'm figuring out how to, as churches are calling us and saying, how can we help in New Orleans? We say, come stay in our building, and we'll find stuff for you to do. So I would go and find work in the community. So I guess I'm getting off track a little bit. So we church planted in that community. That led to church planting. So I started a church, helped start a church in the area of New Orleans that had completely flooded. Hmm. Sold my house, bought another house in that community. And so in the midst of that church planting journey, because church planters don't really have enough money to pay their bills.
Right.
So in the midst of that, I was like, well, Army Reserve chaplaincy is a way for me to supplement my income from a practical standpoint to get like health insurance.
Right.
Through TRICARE. And to extend my ministry in a lot of ways. So that's really what led me into chaplaincy. And chaplaincy, you know, of course, the military gave me some specific training that was related to chaplaincy. But then once I really started looking at professional full-time chaplaincy, I did a clinical program called CPE, which is Clinical Pastoral Education. It was a one-year residency, so I spent a year in a hospital just providing, being trained on how to respond as a chaplain to people in moments of crisis. And it was really transformative because they really, it was seven of us that did it together. So it was like a cohort community kind of experience. We get really vulnerable with one another. You would take visits with patients and you would transcript the entire visit. And as you transcripted what was said back and forth, you would also kind of have side notes of what you were thinking all through, like why you made certain decisions, why you asked certain questions. And we would go through these together and it just like, it would allow us to really recognize how much when we do ministry, our own stuff can get in the way, you know, if we're not self-aware. And so it was a really great program that really helped me just as a man and as a minister, and really set me up well to function in a more healthy, kind of spiritually, emotionally healthy way as a chaplain.
Can you give me an example of that? Like what are some of the things that you recognize in that training of like that could get in the way of the work for working with someone else?
Yeah. So as you can maybe imagine, if you are functioning as a hospital chaplain, you can be in moments where you're standing at a bedside and the person who is sitting in the bed and is sick or dying somehow reminds you, maybe on a conscious or maybe on an unconscious level, of something in your own past. So I remember having a patient, a hospice patient who was dying. She reminded me so much of my own grandmother who had died not too long before this. And so I felt like in some ways emotionally in those moments, it was like I was having conversations with my grandma that I loved and that I had just lost. And I think one of the things that CPE helped me to do was to just acknowledge that, like be more reflective on my visits with her, to be able to acknowledge that to myself, maybe even to some teammates who I trusted, who were encouraging and helpful to me. And then it could become, instead of something that might deter from my ministry, where I would make the whole conversation maybe about what I wanted or needed. Right. Yeah. I could maybe harness those emotions in a good way to maybe help me to be more empathetic, to connect with her in maybe a different sort of way than I would otherwise.
Yeah. So I have a question. I have like 14 in my head right now, but the one that pops out the most in the time that you've done this for 12 years and you were a pastor. So you were familiar with grief and walking with people through grief. But these are people that they were part of your congregation. You had possibly some connection with them already. Shifting into chaplaincy, what did you learn or how did grief show up in a new way or understanding for you, changing that dynamic to strangers that you just walk up to and you're there for comfort?
Yeah. That's a great question. So, I mean, I could go in a lot of different directions now. I answer this question.
Yeah.
But what I will say this. So a chaplain.
I do want to say I welcome rabbit trails. I'm fine with that. Rabbit trails are great. Okay. They're welcome here. Yeah.
So it, one of the unique roles about a chaplain is you are there short term, not long term. And I often, like, one of the images I think of when I was a kid, I shared, like, I remember when I was little, me and my brother and sister, we were all pretty close in age. We all slept in the same bedroom. I can't remember how old I was, but my little sister, I remember she would be scared to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you know, the boogie monster is going to get her or whatever.
Yeah.
So she would wake either me or my brother up and coax us into walking down the dark hallway to the bathroom with her, just to make sure she got to the bathroom.
Right.
And it just annoyed me to no end that I thought it was silly, but, you know, I just remember her begging for this little walk me to the back, to down the hall.
Yeah.
And I think of that image, like, a lot of ways, that's kind of what a chaplain does. So, I can think of just very recently, I was with someone who unexpectedly, total stranger, unexpectedly lost someone, who died younger than they should have. And this person was with them and basically when they died. And so this person is in shock. Police are called in. And so the police recognize pretty quickly, hey, this person's in an emotional crisis, and they offer the chaplain. And so they call me, I come out there and I just sit with her, and she's able to say things out loud. In fact, she said some things out loud and then said, it feels so good to say that out loud. And just the nature of the situation, there were elements of the dynamic that she probably would not be able to share with very many people. But the fact that I was a chaplain, which meant I was there just to listen, whatever she said to me, and, you know, in the midst of police officers walking around, right?
Yeah.
Whatever she says to me is confidential. She can just say whatever and not have to worry. And it was an open invitation for her to just reflect on the moment. And at the end of the conversation, I was with her for maybe 30 minutes. And we even had a conversation about the fact that she had a long-term counselor that she would be able to rely on down the road.
Yeah.
And I was thankful that I was able to kind of at least have that part of, you know, bridge that a little bit in her mind.
Right.
But she recognized, like, I'm never going to see you again. And that's great. You know, like, you listened to me, you sympathized with me, you prayed over me. And I know I've got other resources that are going to help me long term, but you got me through this moment. And so there is something about that acute moment of trauma. And of course, you know, depending, like, as a hospice chaplain, that moment looks very different than it might at a homicide scene.
Right.
You know, because of the nature of the situation. But regardless, my ministry is in the moment, being in the moment, present in that moment. And in some ways, I'm there to listen and to normalize what they're experiencing. But in other ways, I'm, you know, from a spiritual perspective, I'm a reminder that God is present with them and God is with them in that moment. And it's amazing how many times I've seen God's presence reveal itself in a way that almost catches me off guard, but especially can catch the person off guard, when sometimes they might not really have a relationship with church, with faith, at least not an active, healthy one. And they can be caught off guard with the sense of God that they feel in that moment and how it can help them. So.
Wow, that's powerful. Which makes me think of, like, the dynamic of outside of a church. In the church, you had the most benefit of the people sitting there are in congruence with whatever the church stands for. But then you're also outside in an environment where you might run into somebody who's like, yeah, I don't believe that, but you can comfort. So what have you seen in the way of of working as a chaplain as it relates to the way different cultures, whether it be the way somebody was raised, their background or upbringing or cultural experience, has shaped the way that they're approaching that very grief.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think growing up in a city like New Orleans, I've spent most of my life around other cultures. I've spent a lot of time where this is kind of crazy to say, and I hope this doesn't sound the wrong way, but as a white dude, there's a lot of times I've been the minority in the room, which is very different than being the minority. I clarify that, but I've been in a lot of situations where I've engaged people from other cultural backgrounds. And so I kind of took pride, especially as a New Orleanian, that I know what it's like to, I'm diverse, you know, this is not the typical South, you know, this is, I understand other cultures and all that kind of stuff. But one thing there were things I would pick up really quickly about, okay, this culture is going to grieve differently than this culture. This culture is, the emotions are going to come out. They're going to just let it all out real quickly. And then once it's all released, then they're going to settle. Whereas this culture over here is not going to show any emotion. And it's they're going to,
in the range of normal.
Right. Yeah. They're going to act like nothing really happened. Right.
Yeah.
And so I would try to pick up and recognize, okay, how can I provide ministry here as opposed to here? You know, maybe I read scripture, maybe I pray in a different cadence, you know, I would take a lot of pride in doing that. And I still definitely discern and listen. But one thing I've learned over time is you can't ever make any assumptions. Mm. Like, when you walk into a relationship, it doesn't matter if the person's Black or white. It doesn't matter if they're from the city or from the country. Like, you might have an idea of what you think their cultural background is going to be like, but you have to walk in with a curious spirit and saying, I think I might know. I think you might be the kind of person that would want me to pray in a certain way. You know, like, to be a little bit more boisterous in my prayer, and that might be helpful to you. Or you might be the kind of person that wants me to pray in a more somber way.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to make that assumption. I'm going to visit with you. I'm going to have a conversation with you. And one of the terms we use in the chaplain world is you're conducting a spiritual assessment. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking, you're asking questions, and some people even almost have like a checklist. I don't quite take it that way, but I'm having conversations, and I'm listening, and I'm learning in the moment of what this person is like and what their spiritual needs are. And as those come to the surface, I'm trying to figure out how do I meet those needs in a way that's going to be helpful to you to get through this really hard, difficult day.
Yeah. Which is so fascinating, especially in light of you being an army chaplain and a police chaplain. It's like these are government agencies, and that they employ people who are, they see the value in the work that you're doing, even on a spiritual plane of assessing people and helping them to connect to that, or could connect to that. Do you? I'm trying to think of how to word this. When you're in those environments, who are you speaking to? Is it going to be somebody who lines up with a certain, theology or ideology, or how are the chaplains assigned?
Yeah. So that environment, the amount of ministry I can provide, I'm responsible to help people meet their spiritual needs, right? Now, the way that I do that is going to look really different depending on what your maybe faith tradition is. So I have a couple police officers that are Muslims. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when it's been Ramadan is going on, I would kind of check on them. How are you doing? Are you participating in Ramadan? Is there ways that I can kind of help kind of support you? Mm-hmm. Even if it's just, let me talk to your rank and make sure they understand your religious practices and how this might affect your performance on the job, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's a different sort of way of meeting a religious need, you know?
Right.
Whereas, so if someone is Roman Catholic, so Roman Catholicism is different than my faith tradition in many ways, but in many ways it's very, very similar. So mm-hmm. I can read scripture. I can pray with you. I can talk about spiritual things. I can share things and say, hey, from my faith tradition, this is kind of how we do it. And they might share something different from their own faith tradition. I remember having hospice patients that were Jewish. And so I love to read scripture, especially in that setting. I love reading scripture. And I would read Psalm 121 I loved reading Psalm 121. And I could do that with a Jewish patient because I know that's a commonality we have in our faith scriptures, you know, and yeah. It could be very meaningful to them.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Have you ever had any experiences where it was not welcome? What you were offering was not welcome.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes when you are in those moments, people deal with it in all sorts of different ways. You know, I mean, as you can imagine, people can experience a lot of anger.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've been the brunt of their anger, you know, like, and I'm, if that's what I can do to help you in that moment is that you can yell at me.
Yeah.
Then that's okay. I'll let you yell at me. And I try to come with very much of a, I'm coming to be helpful to you. What can I do to be helpful to you right now? I just want to introduce myself. My name is Doug. I'm a chaplain. I'm here to help you in any way I can in this moment. How are you feeling? You know, is there anything I can do that can be helpful? Would it be helpful to you if I prayed right now? There's lots of times I don't necessarily pray with people. Sometimes I just have a conversation with them.
Yeah.
And I have to kind of discern, and a little bit of that is discerning from them and discerning from the Holy Spirit if I should pray or not. Yeah. And sometimes there's a little bit of a risk that I'll take. And you're looking for God's guidance in those moments. I've definitely had times where I've been told, no,
yeah.
get away from me.
Yeah.
Or they'll yell at me related to their emotions towards God in that moment, you know, or they'll ask me those really hard questions, you know, and I'll sometimes if I'm able to have a conversation after that, I've talked about how the Saint Augustine, he says that when we read the Psalms, the Psalms teach us how to pray with all of our emotions. Mm. And so there are Psalms where the psalmist, everything's wonderful. And the psalmist said, oh, I'm on the mountaintop and, you know, I want to be, I could sing of your love forever and all this kind of stuff. So there's Psalms like that. And then there's other Psalms where David is in the cave and he's angry and he's confused and he doesn't, God, why are you, where are you, God? You know, so God is okay with us asking the hard questions. God is okay with us showing anger in those moments and confusion and fear, you know, God's okay with that. And so if he can take it.
Yeah.
And so I've definitely seen people express those feelings in my presence, somewhat because of my presence.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Right. Well, and I think when people finally catch on to that, the vulnerability and authenticity that can show up there can be so incredibly powerful to be able to accept all of the experience that they're having. And you're facing people that, okay, so I'm not sure where would you, I understand hospital chaplaincy, you would be showing up to a bedside of someone who is on the, like, they're close to the end. Is that right? Is that fair to say? Okay. And hospice, again, the same thing. Mm-hmm. I guess hospital, you might have just doing rounds with patients and just seeing if they are up for that encouragement. What mm-hmm. happens in the Army setting and the police setting?
So in the Army setting, you're really just taking care of soldiers, you know, like service members. It's not like you would go to war and spend time with, you know, people that live in the community where the war is happening. I mean, you might a little bit, but for the most part, your job is to spend time with soldiers. So you're part of a unit, you're going through the training with them, you're out in the woods, in the tents with them, and you're experiencing everything they're experiencing kind of alongside of them. So in the police setting, it's a little different. It's almost like a mixture of the military role in that you're mm-hmm. taking care of police officers in a similar sort of way as they're going through the secondary trauma of having to respond. I've seen more combat trauma in police officers than I have in soldiers, to be mm-hmm. honest. Because, yeah. You know, the amount of violence, the amount of it's pretty crazy out there. But so you're taking care of police officers, but then you're also taking care of just people who have just experienced, you know, mass horrific events. So. Yeah. And that could be everything. It could range from my brother just died unexpectedly. Maybe it's a drug overdose. Maybe it's a heart attack. You know, who knows? To my boyfriend just shot himself in front of me because he was mad at me and he killed himself like in front of me. You know, to you know, like I just showed up because my grandpa was walking across the street and got hit by a car. Wow. You know? So, I mean, it can be the whole range of kind of different experiences.
Wow. And so how, I mean, you're walking into it. It reminds me of, just doula work. Honestly, there's the, mm-hmm. I mean, I worked as a doula for 10 years, but you're taking somebody that's pretty standard procedure that they're going through or the process of labor, and every person handles it differently. There's so many dynamics, but it's pretty much you walking into somebody's shock. Like that's what it seems like. And then you go from that situation to kind of like you've got a process of how to be with them in that moment, and you're the first contact, and then hopefully mm-hmm. setting them up with resources, or if they making sure they have resources for further down the road. Right. What is your go-to strategy when you're facing shock?
Yeah, I mean, you being a calm, empathetic presence. So if I show up and somebody is laying on the floor, you know, because they are so overcome by emotion, then I'm going to get down on the floor with them, you know, to try to get on their level. And so there's a mix of kind of being empathetic and mirroring on some level, but there's also where your composure is almost a contrast in that you can be the calm, peaceful presence. I remember one time I was in the hospital. There was a gentleman who had a heart attack. He's rushed into surgery to try to repair the damage to his heart. He had his wife and three young adults, like I think they range from maybe 19 to 25 years old, are in the waiting room, you know, waiting to find out if he's going to survive the surgery. And these four women are just like emotions all over the place. You know, they're pacing the room, they're yelling, they're screaming, they're crying. And I'm sitting calmly with them. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there calmly for 10 minutes, for 30 minutes, for an hour, you know, and just having calm conversation. And often I'm just sitting silently with them. And at one point, the oldest daughter turns to me and she goes, "How can you be so calm?" How can you be so calm? And I, in my mind, I thought, and I might even, if I'm really honest, I might have even said it to some degree, but I think she caught what I meant. I said, well, it's not my dad.
Yeah.
You know, like and I was giving her permission to quote unquote overreact, you know, like just let it all out. Be angry right now. You don't have to have it together emotionally right now. Let me be the one who can be the calm, peaceful person in this kind of, in this dynamic right now. So you don't have to be.
Yeah. And I think that's so powerful as a picture of what, even as us that don't have a chaplaincy or have gone through that program, but wanting to be present for those that we love and wanting to be present for those that are going through hardship or trauma or just awful situations. And how I get that question all the time. Okay, what do I do? And I feel like a lot of people, it's like this hard to sit on your hands kind of thing. If you're used to feeling like you've always got to have the right thing to say, you've always got to know how, what to do, rather than being and allowing other people to be. And I love that example that you are the, it's like you're providing the container for them to just go, you know, to be fully, fully present, fully seen in whatever they're experiencing. And leads me to the thought of, okay, so you do all that, you hold all that. How are you then integrating back into your day-to-day life when you're used to being that for others? Like, how do you, what's the restorative work that you do for being able to continue to do that and not get burnout?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to some degree, there's probably a level of you're kind of a visitor in these moments on some level. So some things maybe don't soak all the way in to me. Like maybe they could. Maybe that's part of the reason I'm able to survive doing this job. You have to have intentionally planned spaces where you can get this stuff out. So one thing the chaplain as a profession is really good at is chaplain profession often creates those spaces. So for example, in my current role as a police chaplain, I get together with all the police chaplains. There's five of us total assigned to the New Orleans Police Department. We get together once a week. Mm-hmm. And one part of that meeting is let's create space for you to share the story, whatever stories you need to share of what happened this week. So, and especially, you know, one of us has been on call, which means they're most likely to have gotten those crazy stories. So I just got off call, for example. So for the past week, I had to be ready 24/7 to respond to anything in the city. During daytime hours, if something happens and another chaplain's working and it's their area of the city, I can just hand it off to them. But at night, it's just me. And so when we met earlier today, my senior chaplain, he turned and said, "Doug, what was your week like? You know, what calls did you have? What do you need to talk about?" And I shared a little bit, and I didn't share everything, you know, just as it was one of those situations that I was like, you know what, it's probably, I'm okay. I handled it okay emotionally, as I've kind of checked myself. I don't need to tell the whole story, and it almost would feel like gossip a little bit if I told this whole story. So I didn't share a lot of details. But then there's been other weeks where I'm like, I'm just, you know, like letting it all out to the whole story, all the details. And sometimes you might share the story and turn to your teammates and say, "Do you think I handled this okay? Do you think when I said this to them, do you think that was okay?" You know, like to kind of get their feedback, or how could I have handled this better?
Yeah.
So having those kind of spaces where we have people who we trust, who understand what we do, and can speak into it is really important. On top of course, having counselors and therapists and people like that you can turn to as well.
Right. Right. That's so incredible. I mean, okay, so so many rabbit trails I could go on. When you're doing this work, what have you learned about the way, I guess this might apply more to the hospital hospice side. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When people are at the end, maybe let's go hospice.
Yeah.
What are the ways that people feel like they're not prepared mm-hmm. for what they're facing? What do you see there?
Yeah. So when someone gets placed in hospice care, then that what that essentially means, textbook definitions, it means a doctor has diagnosed you with something that they would project that you will die within 6 months. Mm. And so the treatment plan shifts from trying to treat this malady, try to cure you, quote unquote, cure you of it, to now we're just going to focus on your quality of life, making you comfortable from mm-hmm. a medical standpoint, right? So that's the textbook definition. Now, in our culture, when people hear you're being put on hospice, they almost think of like Dr. Kevorkian. Was that his name?
Yeah.
In Asia, you know, like they think, okay, like they think about like when I had to put my dog to sleep, right? So
yeah.
So when people get a diagnosis of hospice, oftentimes their initial reaction is very strong. Mm. Like, oh, wow, I'm going to die. And so my first visit as a hospice chaplain is often helping them to manage the shock of this new piece of knowledge. Like, this is real, like right. I'm really going to die. And I've even had people ask me, what is it going to feel like? Like, what's going to happen when I close my eyes? What's on the other side?
Yeah.
Interesting that
you've never gotten that story from someone.
I might be a preacher. And so I might talk to God a lot, but I really don't know what's on the other side of the curtain, you know?
Right.
But so that first visit, I often think a hospice chaplain's ultimate goal is to get someone to a place where they're at peace with this, with the reality of their situation. So that first visit sometimes feels a little bit different than maybe the ensuing visits, as they've had more time to kind of come to terms, come to peace with, and that's more than just the puzzle, right? I mean, that's just time and having the right family with you and dealing with the unfinished business of your life. And maybe that one loved one who lives on the other side of the country that you want to see one last time, they get on in a plane and they show up and you have time with them.
Yeah.
And so you see them kind of come to a place where they're at peace with this being the last chapter of their life.
Yeah.
And so then it's interesting when you visit with someone who's on the other side of that. So I've had people where the conversation's turned all the way to the other side where they'd say, "Chaplain, why am I still here? Like, I'm ready now. Like, I'm just waiting." Like, now they feel like they're just in a waiting room, just waiting for their number to get called, because they're just totally ready.
They've made peace wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, there's no timetable on that. It could be hours, it could be days, it could be months, you know,
until
they get to that place. But when someone gets to that place and you watch, you get to be kind of the fly on the wall in the room and watch them experience the last moments, the last chapter of their life with love around them, with the peace of God. It can be like an amazingly beautiful thing to see. And it feels a bit like sacred ground. Like I think about when Moses, you know, finds the burning bush, and it, you know, the scriptures tell us that he took off his shoes, you know, and he was a shepherd And he was up in the part of the mountain that he probably had tread on for years as a shepherd, right? But all of a sudden, it's sacred, you know?
Yeah.
Common ground had become sacred ground. And you kind of can get that sense in those moments where you could be in somebody's living room and there's a hospital bed there and there's family all around. And all of a sudden, this living room where memories had been made has become sacred because someone's last moments are being spent here, surrounded by love.
Yeah, that is powerful. And in the hospital setting, you're working with people who are maybe dealing with a diagnosis, or what does it look like when, as you're clearly there for the patient, but then you also have family dynamics. What have you seen in the ways that family can show up, that they're handling the situation too? Right. They're navigating their felt experience while also needing to support. What have you learned about that setup?
Yeah, I mean, I could go in lots of different directions. Maybe it's not good. Rachel, you and I were just
talk for 3 hours
all over the place. So, for one, I think it's important to figure out, just from a practical standpoint, who in the family is kind of the family leader, kind of the matriarch or patriarch of the family. And sometimes that person is someone you want to make sure you can identify and you can have you can kind of have good communication with and conversations with, because oftentimes my role, as we have already talked about, my role is so temporary in that setting, whereas that person is going to be kind of glue for that family. And so oftentimes helping that person to navigate the rest of the family and their dynamic can be really an important piece of it, just from a practical standpoint. I think I have seen, of course, we bring our own stuff into those situations, right? So sometimes everyone in the room, because they're there in person, they're at peace with this. They understand there's no more treatments. I can't yell at the doctor and tell them to try something else. Like, this is it, right? So they've all, and I'm going to say my goodbyes and I'm okay with that. But then you've got the one family member who can't get in town and they live in California and they're on the phone. And they're the ones that are saying, get the doctor on the phone. I started Googling and, I've been on this and they need to try this treatment. And like, you can see that they're almost still in denial. They're still wanting. And so they're disrupting in some ways. Yeah. They're disrupting the emotional experience processing of the rest of the family.
Yeah.
And they're allowing their own kind of emotions, which probably have more to do with maybe guilt, because they're not there,
able to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe they haven't been present, you know, like for years, you know, and they're dealing with all that. So, I mean, you definitely see those dynamics come into play and have to try to navigate those. I mean, the other side is sometimes that person can see people who maybe have had fractures in their relationship and they're able to come to a place of peace. And some of the quote unquote unfinished business is taken care of for that person before they die. And that can be a really beautiful thing. I've seen that, where you've got the prodigal child who sits at the bedside with their mom or dad and is able to have a conversation that can be so meaningful for both the person, the loved one, the family member, and for the person who is dying.
Right. And it just, I mean, and I know that's so beautiful on the one hand. On the other, it's like this longing that that repair could have been made before that, you know, like that it wouldn't take death or this final separation for repair, but it just offers such a perspective. The finality of that does offer that sense of urgency to like, let's repair this. Do you find that that happens? Like that's a frequent thing that people become more open to that sense of, like, I'm curious, like, if you can feel, and I'm sure you can, the difference between what's genuine repair versus just a very quick, like, I don't know, you could tell when it was not done in sincerity.
Yeah. So that's part of the training that we get as chaplains. And this is stuff that I wish I'd gotten more of in seminary and Bible college than I did. Is learning a family systems, learning enough about kind of dynamics and things like that, stages of life, things like that, to understand enough to kind of navigate that stuff enough to get them through that moment. Again, I'm not a professional counselor. I'm not there to provide therapy, long-term therapy that's needed. But if I can at least recognize enough of what dynamics are at play in the room and be able to kind of speak into it. And again, I mean, the beautiful thing about faith is faith means that we have a God of grace and mercy. And if he reveals himself, the Spirit of God is present in that room and in that moment, then, God shows up in the midst of our brokenness. So I don't know if it's always a happy ending. I don't know if it's always the perfect repair or solution. But God can bring peace, and that's the best we can maybe ask for.
Yeah. Which you've seen evidence of that over and over again. What would you say with grief and the process of grief and how everybody is approaching it differently?
Yeah.
And then you add in the aspect of faith, which so much you mentioned that sometimes people are angry and they have questions. And by the way, the Enneagram 5 loves nihilism, like being able to dive into the depths of philosophy and existential dialogue about the meaning of life and like those conversations, which I love too. Do you have people that it's almost like there's a cerebral function in the inside? Like I would imagine if you're in dealing with grief, well, I say I imagine, but at the end stage of death, like when you're at the end. Because I've seen it in my own life with grief, like there's a very real feeling aspect, emotional aspect. And then as it relates to faith, there is a existential, like it brings you to a place of questioning. Things that aren't nailed down get looked and examined and the lens gets just, it feels like you start to look at things differently when you're in grief. Mm-hmm. How do you have that? Do you see that? Like you mentioned, people will have conversations with you about their anger, but that dynamic of people being, there's an emotional response, and then there's also a very philosophical response that is related to faith. Do you see that in the grief work that you're?
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure every chaplain, just like any minister and every person, right? We bring our own unique wiring into the situation. And so I'm sure, I know there are other chaplains that probably are super driven by their own emotion in a good way. And they're able to harness that and they're able to empathize, like dive deep into empathy in a different sort of way than I do as a chaplain. So as a 5, an Enneagram 5.
An alleged.
I think.
Alleged 5.
So my empathy is different, I guess, in that I am able to have this almost objective Like, I'm able to kind of get into your head a little bit from the standpoint of, like, I can intellectually take my own stuff and my own faith, at least what it looks like, and I can kind of put it aside for a minute and try to really understand everything from your reality. Yeah. And if you're going to say something that would maybe be offensive to my personal faith, I'm not going to allow my emotions in that moment to make it a debate, you know, or something like that, which is not what you need in that moment. Right.
Right. But that's a skill set. Like, that's a genuine, what do you think is the foundation of that?
I mean, to some degree, I think it's how I'm wired, but I know that I've had to work hard as an Enneagram 5. I've had to work hard. I don't know if this really has anything to do with any of that. Rachel, you know, we went to college together, right? So you understand, like, my faith, my practice, everything is grounded in scripture. Like, and so for me to be able to go to scripture and for scripture to show me how God is present in all sorts of spaces that I wouldn't expect them to be present in. I'm working on a doctorate in biblical studies, and I'm diving into the theology that's found in the book of Acts. And one of the beautiful things I think about the book of Acts is God is really the main character of the book. Mm. It's not Paul. It's not Peter. It's not even, it's God himself, and God shows up in all these places. And so the early church walks into these communities. They might go to like when Paul goes to Athens, or when Philip ends up in front of the Ethiopian eunuch, like they're walking in front of these strangers, these people that have totally different cultures and beliefs than they do. And they find out that God's already at work. Yeah, in those moments, right? Yeah. And so I think for me, from a theological kind of personal faith perspective, to believe firmly in my heart and in my mind and grounded in my faith and in scripture, that God is already at work in this room and in this space and in this dynamic. And I want to be able to tap into that. And so I'm not trusting that I'm gonna be the one that has the right thing to say. I'm not trusting that I'm gonna somehow bring God into the room.
In the room. Yeah.
You know, like, oh, Doug's here. The chaplain's here. It's okay. Now God has come in. God has entered the chat, you know. I mean, I'm trusting that God is already at work. And so I guess in some ways that takes this responsibility off of my shoulders and frees me to just follow his lead.
Yeah. That's so powerful. Your confidence, the foundation is the solid foundation you have in your own faith practice that allows you to go into a room without agenda, but with your own practice allows you the perspective of God is bigger than you walking into the room. He's already there. What a powerful perspective. That just means you get to show up and be, and then it's revealed what's needed, and you get to comfort in that way. That's beautiful. Do you find that there have been places your own faith has been tested in this work?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, there are moments. I know one of the things I've learned over time, one of the lessons I've tried and tried and tried to tell myself is if the Spirit of God tells me to pray, as an example, then I need to pray. Okay. And there's been times I've walked out of a visit and I thought, you know what? I knew I wanted to pray at the end, but I was scared to ask. And I thought maybe it would offend them. So I think that's probably there's been times when I, believing that God is taking the lead and I need to follow his lead, there's been times when I have left feeling a little disappointed in myself and unfulfilled that I didn't, thinking that I did not follow his lead like I should have, and that there was an opportunity for God, for God's presence to maybe be revealed more clearly, and I missed it.
Yeah. And very, as a human, because like you said, the fear of, you know, if they, if you said the wrong thing or you offended in a situation, I could understand why that would feel like a, you are constantly having to discern in a moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So trusting that when, so you basically, if you feel the leading to pray, then you know you're going to act on it.
Yeah. And well, and I will say on the other hand, there's been times when I have felt totally inadequate. I felt like I'm not doing anything that's helping anybody. Like this person is completely out of control and I cannot contain them and they're all over the place. And I'm just sitting awkwardly next to them as they're losing it. And then at the end of the visit, the same person turns to me and says, "Chaplain, thank you so much. You're the only one who was truly there for me, you know, this entire time." And like, you're kind of like, I don't know what I did. I didn't feel like I did anything right. But somehow, the fact that you can walk into that space and be a reminder of God's presence, I think can connect with people in a way that transcends my mistakes.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So what do you think is, in your time as a chaplain and you're talking to people who are interested in grief, that's why they're listening to this podcast, or they just love me and I've sworn that they've had to listen or they would get in trouble. What do you want us to know, those that are either going to face these situations or those that are supporting those that are walking through diagnosis and death or trauma in their vocation? Mm-hmm. What do you want us to know that can help us in those situations? And you, however many you can give me, you know, what we learned, 3 points in a prayer, but, you can, an intro, 3 points in a prayer. If you can give us what you think are the practical, hey, this is what I know about grief and, how to be with that.
Mm-hmm. I think probably the biggest lesson that I would share would be that you are unique. You connect with God in a unique way. God has wired you with amazing strength that you might not even be aware of. And so you don't need to experience this like anyone else. You need to experience God and this horrific, difficult moment, and find strength in the way that matches you. And one of the terms that the clinical world uses, so we talk about PTSD, right? Post-traumatic stress disorder. And we talk about PTS, which is post-traumatic stress, which is more kind of everyone experiences it in the moment. If you experience it over a prolonged period of time, it becomes a disorder. So it's PTSD. But the third term that a lot of people have maybe not heard is PTG, which is post-traumatic growth, which is the idea that you go through trauma and in the midst of it, you learn things that maybe even surprise you about yourself and how you manage it. And you realize, you find your strength and you find your voice. I somehow got, like, not in the moment, probably later, right? You get through it and then you reflect upon, how in the world did I get through this?
Right.
You reflect upon it and you're kind of like, oh, wow, I didn't even know I was capable of that. And then you now have this tool as far as your self-awareness and your understanding of your own design and wiring and how you connect with God and all this kind of stuff. You've kind of now got these tools in your tool belt you didn't have before. And so when you get to the next traumatic moment, because we're going to have another one, then you can turn and you can you have tools there that you didn't know were there before, because you've grown through the midst of your trauma. So I would just say, I think my biggest piece of advice is just be curious about yourself, about your own design and wiring, and how the Holy Spirit is going to guide you and connect with you and help you get through difficulty. And if you're able to do, if you're able to do that, then that's sanctification on a whole nother level, I guess.
Very true. Very true. PTG. I love that. I have not heard of that. That's fascinating. Yeah. I've got to look more into that. What's your favorite book that has transformed your understanding of grief or grief work, or in the vein of what you do? What's been a book that's been the most transformative for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. Probably the book I would recommend. So Robert Wicks is a author that has written a lot on resilience. And there's a couple books that he's written that I would definitely recommend. Probably the one that's the most accessible is a book called Bounce. And he talks a lot about post-traumatic growth and resilience and understanding ourselves and our knowledge. He's a person of faith, but professionally, I believe he's like a psychiatrist or something like that. So I would definitely say Robert Wick's work has been really helpful to me in understanding trauma and how to grow and thrive in the midst of that difficulty.
Yeah. And when is that doctorate going to be done?
Not for a while. Yeah.
Like 3 months from now? Is that?
I'm hoping this summer I'm working on my dissertation proposal. So like I kind of alluded to, I'm studying theology in the book of Acts, and particularly the moments in the book of Acts where people who aren't Jewish or Christian, who are some other faith, are coming to the story, and how is God present in those moments? And so if you study all those passages, what can we learn about God's presence outside of our own faith? And so that's really what I'm trying to hold on to, because I don't think there's a lot of, we kind of have all our Bible theology stuff, and then we have the culture we live in, where you're engaging all these people that believe differently than us. That's just the reality of America, Western culture. But we don't bridge those two very well. And so I'm trying to figure out how to help kind of maybe build more of a bridge.
That's beautiful.
So it'll be a while on the
document. Okay, it's going to be a while. You're still figuring it out.
I'll hopefully start writing my dissertation in the fall, and in 4 years or something like that.
Oh, yeah, no.
We'll see.
Oh, that's exciting. Well, thank you for being here and giving us your incredible wisdom from learned experience. I think it's fascinating. I take away just the beauty of, as you said, you get to show up and just be and allow someone else to be. And I think that is such a powerful takeaway for those of us that aren't chaplains but want to be present for the people we love. That you don't have to be a chaplain to learn that skill set of being able to set aside your own agenda and be present with someone. I think that's powerful. But thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
All right. Anytime. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and I will see you the next time.